Good morning. I'm Asha Nayaswamy, and we're continuing our Living in the Light conversations. So let us start first with a prayer. Even putting on my glasses, I'm not going to be any closer to the divine, so we might as well take them off. Swamiji said he couldn't lecture when he at one point he got LASIK surgery on his eyes so that he could see at a distance without glasses. But even when he was very myopic, he said he found it harder to be intuitive with his glasses on. So he had to take them off when he was lecturing, even though he couldn't recognize faces. It's an interesting fact. I mean, I can't say that I can't say the difference. I wore distance glasses for 40 years of my life until I also had the LASIK surgery. What I found was that I had a protective barrier. When I first had to walk out into the world without glasses on, I felt exceedingly vulnerable. It took a long time before I could just meet the world without a barrier. It's very funny how these things develop. Reading glasses, which are a side effect of having the myopia cleared, a perfect trade-off as far as I was concerned. I think when you're reading, your attention is already in something is external to yourself, so it's different. I don't know. The end point is, I won't pray better wearing my reading glasses. So now let's start with the prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Swamiji, help us to understand the deeper meaning behind your simple words. Help us to feel the consciousness that inspired you to write. Help us to receive the vibrations you are trying to share with us. In all ways, guide us so that our lives may come into perfect attunement with the divine will, and that we may know ourselves as we truly are, one with thy infinite light. Om. Peace. Amen. Well, last time we met, I took a fairly long detour from the subject at hand into death, dying, and as I recall, organ donation, which Swamiji did not support, even though it looks very helpful to people. He says the transition between life and death is far too sensitive to invite surgeons in to be cutting up your body when you have barely detached yourself from it. That's the short version. Look at the last week, the film before this one, if you want to know more about that. But what we had been working with was this paragraph, which is on the second page of this pamphlet, A New Dispensation, which Swami wrote in 1983. And this is about attunement. Swamiji is talking about what it means to be on this path. Over the years, too, and I know I've read this out loud, but I'm going to read it again. Over the years, too, Swami writes, I've made a few specific observations. For one, that those who serve this work selflessly are those also who gain the most from it, and that those, again, who try to share with others the light they receive gain more spiritually than those who keep it to themselves. As Master said, the instrument is blessed by what flows through it. That they gain the most who seek attunement with others more advanced than they themselves are on the path. And that they gain the most finally who realize that soul attunement with this path is more important even than long hours spent in meditation without the companion effort to establish such inner attunement. Now he's going to really support these with more comments, but let's just make sort of have some clarity about what we're talking about. So the first is those who work selflessly serve the work selflessly. Part of this is opportunity. And he uses some examples here. There was a certain time in Ananda's development, and it would have been just around the same period of time that this was written, the late 70s, after the fire, from 1976 to about 1983 or 4, when Swamiji, after a great deal of Ananda burned down in this big forest fire in 1976, and he was just finishing writing The Path, and it was published the following, just about a year after the fire burned, The Path was finished, his autobiography, and it was published. But Swamiji also then, as soon as he finished writing that book, he spent the next year writing that book and then set out on what we called the joy tours, which were these, he went back and forth across the United States twice in that year, twice in a year, took 12 people with him and just put on this huge outreach effort. And then he went to San Francisco and he sent devotees to Sacramento to start a center there. And he sent devotees Jyotish and Devi to San Francisco to start a center there, and himself went to live in San Francisco for a number of months to help facilitate that development. And he just, in every way, was for several years, he was rarely at Ananda Village. He was constantly working to expand Ananda's reach in all directions. And at the end of that period of time, he said, basically, he said it essentially in these words, I'm not trying to create an empire. I'm not just trying to expand Ananda sort of as much as we can expand it. He said, my only purpose is to make Ananda broad enough and varied enough that every devotee who wants to be part of it can find a meaningful way to serve. And that was just an extremely interesting, the way he was saying it. The point here is that every devotee will have a meaningful way to serve. And if Ananda is too small or too specialized in what it offers, then many good people would be able to draw from it, but they wouldn't be able to give back in the same way, give of their own energy, because those gain the most from this path who are also able to serve selflessly. I think the single most difficult thing that I've felt in the role that I've had since 1987 of trying to help develop an Ananda community here in the Silicon Valley is to find meaningful work for all the devotees who would like to serve. And I felt frustrated by the limits of my own magnetism, because Swamiji's magnetism was so enormous that he could just keep creating projects after projects. I mean, this is one that is a bit extreme, but it is very interesting. Swami was always, I think the phrase is, an early adopter. He was always interested in new technology. He didn't himself, he wasn't interested in technology from a technical point of view, but he was always interested in things that were leading to Dwapara, and that seemed to be on the edge of that, or that would use technology to advance creativity. And writing music for him, receiving melodies and knowing that those melodies were right, even writing lyrics for the melodies he received, was not arduous in itself. But writing down all the music was always a big project. So when this computer system, I believe it might have been called Finale, but I'm not sure, a computer system came out, an early computer system came out that would you could play it on the keyboard and it would automatically write it. And it was just such a potential aid to Swami's creativity. It just could open the floodgates of his musical creativity, which ultimately that kind of technology did. But this was an early version. It was extremely complicated and far beyond Swami's capacity to run it himself. So he hired this man, a devotee in our community. I won't mention his name for various reasons, but I'll just say he fired this man. And And for a year, this man worked side by side with Swami to try to make this thing work. In the end, it was just a hopelessly flawed machine. It was just too early in the system, and they weren't. It wasn't able to do for Swamiji what he wanted. But that man was side by side with Swamiji for a year. Now, I presented this story once as an example of Swamiji's early adaptation and his expansiveness and so on like that. The person who'd been the technician for Swami contacted me and told me that there was an entirely different subplot going on. And he said that he himself was on the edge of leaving Ananda and probably leaving the path. And he was sort of making plans for an exit. And it was complicated. He had a family, and it was very complicated. And Swamiji, just out of the blue, called him up and asked him if he would come and work with him on this machine. Now, as it happened, the man had other addiction issues that ultimately Swami was able to postpone it but not prevent it. But still, that man spoke to me, and he spoke to me on the other side of the difficulties in the middle of the difficulties that finally overwhelmed him. But he still spoke of the tremendous power and benefit of that year with Swamiji. The opportunity to serve. He spoke of it first as the opportunity to serve, and then also the opportunity to serve the work directly by serving Swami. So it's a tremendous issue on the spiritual path, and Ananda itself is able to provide only up to a point. After that, but one of the tremendous advantages of living within an Ananda community, being part of this life in a more than superficial way, is that it does open the doorway to all kinds of service. And there's a very interesting karmic cycle that's set up, which is, even if you do something as small, maybe you're not the person who can deliver the class or lead the kirtan, but somebody has to set up the chairs, somebody has to run the sound system, somebody has to keep the records of who came. You know, just there's lots of things that don't necessarily put a person in the limelight or don't feel like I'm directly transmitting these teachings. But all of that effort creates the flow that allows the transmission to happen, and everybody who contributes is caught up in that karmic wave, literally the good karma of helping people. I realized at a certain point that, you know, the small service that I was able to do for Swamiji, that I could fix him a dinner, for example, but then he would write a book, or he would go out and you know, speak to 1,000 people. And he would draw people to the path. He would completely transform people's lives. And he needed to eat dinner. So if I was able to cook him a dinner, then I was part of that whole flow. So it isn't, that was very direct service. Sometimes service is infinitely less glamorous or seemingly direct. But everything that contributes becomes my part in helping many people come to God. And there's huge blessing in that. And the more determined we are to serve, the more God will open avenues for us. Two different people that I know, because Ananda itself did not provide the fullest opportunity that they felt in their hearts they wanted to be able to serve Master by serving the well-being of others, have become hospital chaplains and hospice volunteers. I've always felt for a long time that those of us who know Master's teachings have a tremendous amount to offer, especially with the death and dying, but also with any kind of illness where karma is tough and it's hard for people to hold their equanimity. You don't have to be initiating people into Kriya to be serving Master's work, because you can be elevating people's consciousness, which goes into the second one. Those who try to share with others the light they receive rather than just keeping that light for themselves, you don't have to put Master's name on it. And this is also what Swamiji is trying to get across in this whole brochure as we go through it. You don't have to put Master's name on it. His name is not the point. It's the vibration of consciousness that flows through him that everyone is looking for. Everyone is looking for a way in to the bliss and power of their own nature. So we're serving the Guru's work if we do anything that helps draw people. I often refer to the dedication to Master's cause of self-realization for all. Help us to give what we can to serve your cause of self-realization for all. So, yes, if you can be explicitly in the center and, you know, passing out copies of Autobiography of a Yogi and teaching people, you know, what the meaning of the words are on page 9, that's wonderful. If you can teach people to meditate and help them to meditate, that's wonderful. But serving the work is sharing the light. And when we consciously and deliberately say, this is what I'm here to do. Now, it may not seem necessary for that to be stated, but the misunderstanding about what spiritual life is so all-pervasive and creeps in so sneakily. You know, right now, the image of what Ananda is so vivid, but as time passes and as it sinks to the periphery, and people are drawn to this path in places where there's no Ananda community or no Ananda temple, then every devotee has to say, does that mean I'm precluded from serving the Guru? Does this mean I can't share my light? Of course it doesn't mean that. We have to go to the essence of what's being asked of me. I must serve. And we have to say that to Master, I must serve. And it needs to be not the pamphlet says I should serve. It needs to be a compelling urge from within that this is what I'm going to do. And it's easy to take the Vedantic teachings, and I was talking about this last time, and just say, oh, it's all a dream. Why should I do this? But once we begin to experience what it's like, and this is where the abstraction of the spiritual path becomes concrete, because we feel the blessing of God that flows through us. And in our efforts to serve, our selfishness is revealed to us. We can speak abstractly of wanting to overcome the ego, but it helps to be able to see what it is we're trying to overcome and how it's manifesting in my life. Fears for our own welfare, fears for what other people will think of us, fears from being depleted by having to give too much, you know, just all of these different mistakes within us gradually get cleared out. And also we need the good karma of doing this. I mean, that's a sort of selfish interest for doing it, but it is a motivating force. We need the good karma. I've had this wonderful realization. My father worked hard at the end of his life especially and was fortunate and was able to earn enough money to leave some to his 3 children. My mother was very frugal. So there was not the kind of wealth that you can retire from working, but there was a little chunk of money, which was very welcome. And I used much of it to help Swamiji with what he was doing in India and various other things. And it occurred to me a long time later that I didn't do anything to get that money. I mean, inherited money is an interesting thing because there it is. It is yours. But I never did. I never put out any effort I did nothing creative to earn that. None of my own energy generated that energy. Swami actually even speaks against passive investments for the same reason. This is not popular, but he speaks about, you know, just where the income is passive, but your own creative energy is not engaged. It's just something to think about. When Swamiji inherited money from his parents, when his mother died, his father never understood what Swami was doing and never supported it. Never, as Swami put it bluntly, gave a dime to helping Ananda. So when his father died, he said he had a moral dilemma, which is his father had never given a dime of his money to support Ananda, and he didn't feel his father's soul would rest easy if Swami just gave his inheritance to Ananda to use for various projects. But Swami said his soul would not rest easy if he didn't give it to Ananda's work. So he used that money to create what is now Crystal Hermitage. And what he did was he created a community spiritual center for Ananda. So Swami has an apartment there, but it's a whole beautiful place with beautiful gardens and with a chapel. And now, in fact, there's a mandir where Swami's body is placed. But it's a magnificent, beautiful spiritual atmosphere, which many thousands of people enjoy, and thousands of people will enjoy for generations to come. And it was his father's money that did it. And Swami, out of that, got a very good place for him to live, and as it turned out, a place for his body to rest, too. So it was personal for him, but also impersonal for Ananda. And good karma for his father. And that's what I was realizing for my father. Swami was, when that money came into my hands, Swami was beginning to record his television shows for India, daily television shows, and it cost some thousands of dollars to do that. And I was very pleased that my father helped create those television shows. Millions of Indian people saw those shows. Master's name became known. Swami Kriyananda became a national figure because of those television shows. And the work my father did in his lifetime helped make that possible. My father was not on this path. He would not have been able directly to tell anybody about Yogananda. He probably could not have pronounced his name. But that's what I'm talking about how it runs through. So if nothing else, you serve by giving money. Tithing is the ideal way to do that. I've talked about this on these conversations because it's so important. Tithing means you give a percentage. So you just give a percentage. You don't give a fixed amount. So whatever you have a little less. 10% is the tradition. But that 10% then goes to support people spiritually by you supporting what you believe in. Others are able to get it in a way that you can't directly give, but might not happen in the same way if you didn't give. So always think, how can I serve? How can I serve? And how can I share the light? Is saying, yes, of course, I'm seeking my own self-realization. That's why I'm drawn to this path. But part of my self-realization is to give away what's given to me. To radiate our light to others, rather than just saying, what do I care? I'll just go into my cave and that'll be good enough for me. Then he says, then he starts talking about attunement. Those they gain most who try to attune themselves with others who are more advanced. If we're fortunate, we have personal relationships. But in this age of books and internet, videos and live recordings, we can always keep the company of saints. And always, attunement is a little more subtle than just learning. But it's just trying to orient ourselves to have our lives be in harmony with their lives. That's how Swamiji, he modeled himself after Master. Even though they were different in countless ways, so when Swami would decide what was the right way to be, he would attune himself to the way Master was. How did he relate to people? What were his values in relating to people? How did he present the teachings? How did he respond to other people's errors? I realized in myself that I was instinctively doing that in a very small way, which is I learned to cook, basically to cook for Swamiji. I was also cooking for the community, but the way it ended up, Swamiji taught me to cook, and I cooked for him. And I ended up with a rather specific cooking style is the only way I could describe it. And when I actually stopped to ask myself, where did this style come from? It was very simple. It was the way Swami preferred to eat. And what motivated him in terms of the balance between, you know, the importance of food tasting good, that it be well prepared, that it be attractive on the plate, versus it just being simply healthy. When I cook for myself, I cook much more plain and much more just health-oriented. Swami wanted healthy food, but he also wanted, the word maybe is elegance, a certain refinement in the way it was cooked. And because of that, that just simply became the way that I did it. And in countless ways, you know, the house that I live in when Swamiji moved into it, and when Swami visited it for the first time, the house is very attractive, but the chandelier in the dining room was just, was ugly. It just wasn't I may phrase it differently. It just didn't match the vibration that was appropriate for this house. And Swamiji just looked at it, and it happened to be my 60th birthday. And he said, I'm going to buy you a chandelier for your birthday. I have to just say absolutely outright, chandelier is like a word that I never repeat. And God knows I never wanted one. You might even say actively, I didn't want one. Swamiji wasn't even feeling that well, but we had a wheelchair for him. He insisted on going to this very nice little shop that was just a few miles from here. And in the wheelchair, going up and down the aisle, looking at the chandeliers, and I'm just walking with him thinking, you know, where is this going to end? And he finds this chandelier, which is made entirely of round crystal balls, the kind of round crystal balls that you hang in your window to make rainbows in the house. And it's just nothing but a flat plane and perhaps, I don't know, 50 of these balls hanging down on wires. Absolutely charming. We called it the Bubble of Joy chandelier. And it's here in the house, and I see it every day. And it reminds me, of the vibration of consciousness on which Swamiji lives. Attunement is very, very subtle. I didn't have to have a chandelier. I would never have bought it on my own, but I could see that the other one didn't have the right vibration. What it shows me, when we associate ourselves with those who are more advanced to us, it's not merely that they teach us how the Kriya breath should be, or give us some subtle new understanding of the yamas and the niyamas. And that's where the word attunement comes when they teach us what is the proper response to everything. And it's not even so much what they did, it's how they did it. When I wrote this book, Light Bearer, which is a, you know, monstrously heavy book, and what my intention was in writing this book is that Swamiji explained himself to us. He never just, you know, he never just said, this is what we're going to do, like this. He always explained it to us. And he explained how he thought about things and then how the basic principles that he was using would lead to this conclusion in this circumstance. But this circumstance, whatever it is unique. And we ourselves will constantly be in unique circumstances. So we can't just say, what did Swamiji do? Oh, we have to find a chandelier that's little crystal balls. You know, we may never find another one just like that. It wasn't that he wanted crystal balls, but he had a way of thinking about things. And so when you hear his reasoning, which I did my very best in every situation, not only to tell you the conclusion, but how he got there. Swamiji described Master's way of operating because there's this emphasis put on the blueprint Master left in the ether. Swamiji says they make it seem like it's hundreds of pages of specific predictions of, you know, on January the 10th in 2025, you'll have an opportunity to buy a car, get the green one. You know, it's just sort of like that. He said that wasn't at all how Master worked. Master worked, he said that there is a blueprint in the ether, and the blueprint is a vibration of consciousness. And in his lifetime, he said, Master responded to opportunities as they were presented to him, following those that were in harmony with his essential vibration. And so in order for us to know in large and small ways how to conduct our lives, we need to be attuned with the essential vibration. And that essential vibration is not just how you do the Kriya breath. It's in every situation. How did these great ones respond? Now, you know, Swamiji buying that chandelier for me, for this house, it, you know, even now, I don't quite understand. But there was a certain, I will have to call it tamasic, a certain tamasic resistance in me in regard to the external world. And there was a tremendous freedom in Swamiji in regard to the external world. And beauty, bringing your environment to a certain level of beauty, not to the level of luxury, but to a certain level of refinement, was part of how Swami responded to life. And I don't carry it farther than is natural to me, but every time I see that chandelier, it reminds me to pay attention. You know, to be in tune with Swamiji is to pay attention. I don't have to change the chandelier in my upstairs bedroom. First of all, it's not that ugly. But the other point is, it's not necessary for me. But in this room, which is a public room, where everybody sees it, and I've been in this house now for 12 years, and everybody gets so much happiness from that chandelier. And they especially enjoy the fact that it's a special gift from Swami that he gave to us. These things, too, are important. And these are all part of attunement in a very subtle way. There's more to be said about that, but we're out of time. God bless you, my friend.